Today's show is brought to you by the Davenant Institute. We'll hear more from them later on in the show.
Well, welcome back to the Irenic Protestant Podcast, the show where we strive for the knowledge of God and His Word and His world through the lens of the classical and confessional Protestant tradition. It's been a long time since I said that, so it's kind of, I'm happy I still remembered how to say our intro. But I'm your one of your co-hosts, Jonathan McKenzie. I work for the Davenant Institute as a groundskeeper, and I'm on the Ad Fontes podcast. I do all the little spare things for the Davenant Institute, and I'm currently working on my master's at Davenant Hall. I'm a proud member of the Presbyterian Church in America as well. And I'm joined by, of course, one of our founding original co-hosts, Matthew Pearson. Matthew, how's it going? Introduce yourself.
It's going good, brother. Yeah. My name is, as Jonathan introduced me, Matthew Pearson. I am a graduate from the University of South Florida with the big money-making major, religious studies with a minor in philosophy to add the cherry on top. And what have I been up to? Since graduating, I've been working in restaurant construction. I'm a prospective student at Reformed Theological Seminary in Orlando, meaning I'm not yet a student, but will be soon. I've been accepted in, and I'll be moving up to Orlando shortly. And yeah, I'm looking forward to it. You know, I have one podcast, and that is the Irenic Protestant Podcast with Mr. Jonathan McKenzie over here and some of our other friends. And I've also written two articles for American Reformer. I may be writing for them and maybe some others more in the future, though. So, yeah, that is me.
Good. I'm glad you had the last part. I told you to add that because it makes you sound so cool.
You did.
For the American Reformer. I know. So,
yeah,
you know,
I'm like,
I think it really worked.
I have a published article.
The effect really, really hit, you know. So
yeah, I'm glad. I sound professional now.
Yeah. And we got some unfamiliar faces today. But we also have today one of our new co-hosts for this new iteration of the Irenic Protestant Podcast. We're joined today by my good friend and fellow student, Addison. Addison, how's it going?
It's going good, man. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So if you want to know more about Addison, the last episode of the new Reformed Irenics on the Davenant YouTube channel, you can go there. We did a whole interview with Addison on classical education. And, you know, that podcast started up recently. And you know how gravity works, how there's like, you know, there's bigger bodies, you know, with bigger mass that kind of absorb smaller bodies, a smaller mass. That's what's going on with the new Reformed Irenics and Irenic Protestant podcast. So we've absorbed that little project back into the Irenic Protestant podcast. And we brought Addison along with us. So we're excited to have Addison on with us as one of our new co-hosts. And Addison, proud member of the ARP.
Indeed. Very proud.
It's a good denomination to be proud of, I'd say. And of course, Matthew is a proud member of the PCA. But speaking of members of the PCA, we're joined today by Trent Still, who is a teaching elder in the PCA. Trent, how's it going?
It's going good. I'm glad to be here and honored to be the first guest on y'all's new run of the show.
Yeah, I'm really excited to have you on. So, Trent, could you maybe introduce yourself a little bit, what you're currently doing, where your call is right now, and how long you've been there?
Sure. For those who don't know the PCA lingo, that means pastor. In the PCA, Presbyterian Church in America, I'm located in Aiken, South Carolina. I've been at the same church since 2012, actually. We were here, previous pastor, he left. I was finishing seminary about the same time, graduated in 2019. Ordained June 2020, right in the middle of COVID.
Wow.
And I've been the pastor ever since then. So coming up on 4 years here in June.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So Trent has this last semester was a fellow student with Addison and I in our Westminster Confession class we did with Dr. Lynch at Davenant Hall. Davenant Hall is the sponsor for our show, of course, that you probably heard at the beginning of the intro. So could you maybe talk about how you got interested in Davenant Hall and end up signing up to take a few courses with Davenant?
Yeah, so I've been friends with a lot of the Davenant guys for 10 or so years now. just online. I went to one of the first conviviums in Landrum. A lot of the pictures that you see that are older but look pretty good were taken by my wife. They gave us a one of the conviviums, and she was very pregnant and graciously that so I could go. And actually, you know, I met Brad then and Stephen Wedgeworth and a lot of guys. I was in one of the old Google groups they had when Peter Escalante was still around. That was, you know, I've been around a lot of these guys for a while. And I've always thought a lot of Mike Lynch. Been friends with him online for years and really like his honest approach to Reformed history. And some of my elders had encouraged me to do like continuing education. And when I saw Michael was teaching us on the Westminster standards, I was like, yeah. So that's kind of how I got plugged into that. I haven't taken any other classes and don't really know what the future holds for that, but that's what brought me to that class.
Yeah. It was a great time. It was a very entertaining semester. You know, Trent was one of my fellow, you know, side on the Zoom conversation, you know, commenters on all the fun things that Dr. Lynch had to say during class. You kind of have to be there to really get what Dr. Lynch is about when he's teaching.
He was shushing us.
Yeah. We had a lot of fun in the side comments. So it was great having Addison in there too. Well, transitioning to our conversation for tonight, I wanted to have a conversation just with my fellow great American Presbyterians, you know, in the ether, about the nature of Presbyterian identity. So part of my own story, you know, is I struggled for a long time whether or not I was going to stick around in the Presbyterian world or you know, go down south to England and hop in with the Anglican craze. You know, it's a sexy thing to do in the in this you know, decade, is to go be Anglican. And one thing I struggled with was just the question of identity. What makes this tradition, you know, this tradition, what defines Presbyterianism in the modern day versus what defines Anglicanism? And what I found was, like, man, I really, really love, like, 17th century Anglicans. I kind of vibe with them. They're all kind of Reformed, and they do the liturgy thing, and I kind of agree with them on church authority, these sorts of things. And then I'd go over and look at the Scottish Presbyterians and be like, yeah, I don't think these are my guys. You know, big respect to Rutherford and the boys. I don't know if that's, you know, where I identify with. So I guess that means I must jump over to the Anglican team. And then I kind of discovered, like, well, you know, modern Presbyterianism, at least in the American context, for the most part, is pretty different from like old-fashioned Scottish Presbyterianism. I mean, we sing hymns now. We do corporate prayers with, you know, other people, you know, people besides the minister. And it seems to me that's pretty different from Scottish Presbyterianism. I went to Anglicanism today, and it looks nothing, for the most part, like, you know, 17th century Anglicanism. It's a very, very different thing. And so I kind of just threw out, you know, on Twitter one day, like, you know, what makes Presbyterianism Presbyterian, you know? And so I'd love to hear maybe your thoughts on what makes us Presbyterians today? And does that mean the same thing it did in the 17th century to be a Scottish Presbyterian?
No,
yeah, that's who wants to transgress, you know?
I guess I can add my 2 cents. I mean, it's kind of I'd say it's in the name a little bit, Presbyterian. Our ecclesial polity is you know, a Presbyterian form of church government. So you know, we operate, we, you know, most press, I can't really speak for like all of them, but I assume that other Presbyterian denominations in the U.S. besides just the PCA, like we have our ARP friend in here, Mr. Addison Barton. You know, I assume that every other Presbyterian denomination operates with, you know, a book of church order of some sorts to kind of, you know, ensure that we have a good order within the denomination. So I'd say that part of what makes us Presbyterian is, not just like the Westminster Confession, because there's not like an explicit ecclesial polity laid out there. But part of what makes us Presbyterian is, our church government. So I'd say that that helps inform our identity, especially when you look at like you think of the American Revolution and people calling it the Presbyterian Revolt, and then others saying that American Republican government was kind of modeled off of a Presbyterian ecclesiastical polity. So I guess in American context, what makes us Presbyterian? Our polity.
I'm interested in this. So like when talking about Anglicanism as a tradition, right? I can kind of point to, well, of course, there's like it's defined doctrinally, right? There are in articles, other formularies, but it's also very much defined in its externals, part of its religion, right? That religion is instantiated in time and reality with certain visual aesthetics, a certain form of words and a liturgy that kind of remains until the 70s, pretty consistent, right? Generation after generation. Whereas with something like Presbyterianism, right, we have the doctrine, of course. Like, big part of being Presbyterian is just we have the Westminster Standards, but we don't have like a set necessarily outward form of that religion that kind of remains consistent. So I guess what, like, is Presbyterianism reducible simply to having a Presbyterian polity, and then having this confession of faith? And then kind of run wild, or is it still in some sense kind of connected to being in its origin the Scottish National Church? Like, is it are we Scototyrians, right? How much does that actually play into our identity as modern Presbyterians? I know Addison kind of
So,
said, oh, sorry, go ahead.
yeah, just thinking for me, as far as the journey within Presbyterianism, I s just kind of give you a little more backstory. I was a student at RTS in Charlotte for a very short time, but I had not been Presbyterian but for about 5 minutes, and it became pretty apparent to me that RTS was not. No shade to them, but they're not overly committed to being Presbyterian, right? So I wanted to know what that was. So that's one of the reasons I went to Greenville, and I didn't really know anything about the whole, TR distinctions and confessionalism or anything like that before I got there. And I learned about it while I was there. But even as I studied at Greenville, it became apparent to me that this small but influential group of Presbyterians and the Scots, for some reason, came to be the identifier or the boundaries of what it meant to be Presbyterian. And then you realize, well, there were also English Presbyterians. And then you have the whole Reformed tradition on the continent, which, wasn't Presbyterian in name, but I mean, the differences are minuscule, right? So when you begin to see that Presbyterianism is a better term for it, because referring to it just with reference to church government is true, but it doesn't really say anything. When you say it's Reformed, right, that we're the Reformed Church, then you have a lot bigger bag that you can grab from. And you also see that a lot of what is called, forsaking the tradition or leaving Presbyterianism is not. It's just adaptations. And then, you see that what the American church kind of did, in some ways was novel, but also when you go back and look at the broader Reformation, most of what is being done now, most of it, not everything, is you can really find representation of it in the Reformed tradition, broadly speaking, and certainly throughout church history. One of my fears, or one of the realizations that I came to, was that, and I think it's kind of unfair to call it Scottish, but it is more Scottish than it is anything, was that it's almost like a weird sectarian gatekeeping kind of mindset that so many Presbyterians develop. And I don't think that's inherent to being Presbyterian, and I don't think it's inherent to even subscribing strictly to the Westminster standards. Like going through the class with Dr. Lynch, you're like, man, there's a lot of leeway here. Right? They, you know, certain things they're very particular on, but mostly in general, they're aiming at a very Catholic spirit, I think. So,
right.
Yeah, it's amazing how much of it really was very specifically written to be a compromise document and be really, really inclusive, which is something I did not expect before taking that class with Lynch. And I think as far as the American context goes, you get a little bit more of that Catholicity because it's so eclectic. American Presbyterians just kind of pull, it seems like, from the Reformed tradition on the whole. And then they have that, like, their commitment to the Westminster standards and the form of government. But then I think they feel a little bit more free, at least in general, to kind of pull more broadly. Except for you have some of your smaller Presbyterian denominations that really, really cling to the Scottish identity. Like, I mean, for myself, the ARP still definitely has a very strong Scottish identity. So much so they didn't take on the American revisions to the Westminster rites. They've got a slightly different, even confessional tradition than the rest of American Presbyterianism does. But I think outside of those smaller pocket denominations, you do get this very broad, mostly just kind of like, we're Reformed and we baptize infants and we agree with this type of church government, kind of. And then from there, we just kind of pull from, you know, whoever it is, Bobbing, Puritan, Calvin, Edward Lee, right? Rutherford, if you want, Gillespie, you can kind of pull from all of it.
Right. Yeah, I kind of wonder if kind of the, I said kind of twice, so excuse me, but I wonder if what kind of makes American Presbyterianism is just the fact that the American context, you know, because Presbyterianism is brought over to the colonies that time through Irish Presbyterians, you know, Scots Irish Presbyterians arriving. It's not even like a direct link to like the Church of Scotland, you know, it's kind of one step removed. But when you're beginning a new church in colonies that already have other established churches and other forms of European religion near you, like in Scotland, right? All you have is Scottish Presbyterianism. Right. So it's kind of like it's insular thing that kind of affects itself and is able to make kind of its own identity, because you don't have Dutch Reformed churches next to Presbyterian churches in Scotland. Right. Because they're just all Scottish Presbyterians. Right. But like in the American context, you know, you now have a Presbyterian church, which right down the road, you can have your Dutch Reformed church. And then right down the road, you can have your Episcopal, you know, Anglican church. And then right down the road, you can have a German Reformed church. And all of a sudden, what you kind of see is all these different forms of European Calvinism are coming over and kind of existing alongside of each other, right? And I think they kind of tend to rub off on each other. You know, just kind of think about, in some way, like every U.S. Rendition of like English religion gets a little bit anglicized, right, by the Anglo-dominant culture, right? I mean, Baptists back in England never celebrated Christmas. They never celebrated Palm Sunday. But not every Baptist church in the country, you know, besides maybe a few Reformed Baptist churches here and there that are trying to be extra pure, celebrate Christmas and have a Christmas tree, which isn't even English, that's a Lutheran thing, right? And so you kind of see like part of like maybe what it means to be an American Presbyterian is to actually be American and kind of be affected by the other Protestant traditions being right next to us, where we kind of rub off on each other and it kind of becomes its own distinct sort of Reformed church. I don't know if you all have any thoughts on that and the nature of kind of the Americanness of that enterprise.
Yeah,
yeah, I mean, go ahead. No, you're a host, sir. Go.
Okay, sure. Well, we should always defer to our guests, though. I want to be hospitable.
No, you're ARP. You're a real Presbyterian. You can have it.
Well, I mean, it's the stereotype of like the American melting pot, but there's a reason that that's a stereotype, because you have all these influences coming in. And I think a way we see it is like, how many, you know, American Presbyterian pastors, their favorite theologians are early American Congregationalists, right? Those New England Puritans, right? They're not Presbyterian, but yet we love them, right? And they did good stuff. There's a lot of overlap. So we feel this kind of freedom to be able to pull from their work, right? Maybe not in ecclesiology, but perhaps, you know, in other areas. That just seems to be how I think the Presbyterian Church in America kind of always existed. But on some level, kind of how it even existed in the continent, right? I mean, the guys writing the Westminster were still reading and pulling from continental sources.
Right.
Right. In many ways, if you want to take the Westminster Assembly as kind of the standard for what Presbyterianism is, it was always a Catholic enterprise. And it was always free to pull, right, from a larger tradition.
Yeah,
I was thinking about just the relationship between nature and grace, and how that informs a lot of this, because it's a fool's errand, really, to think that what, in my opinion, is a fool's errand, what God's intention is for all Presbyterian churches to simply be what George Gillespie would do, right? I mean, you have to have a certain understanding of the people. There's a reason that all the different countries had their own confession, and they had their own little flavor, right? They, you know, the Heidelberg Catechism, they say it's, you know, more pastoral than the Westminster Catechisms and whatnot. I mean, you know, make of that what you will, but in so many instances of, and I even, you know, I'm very open to the church calendar, and that's not super common among Presbyterians, but like, I think if you take, especially like the narrow approach, or the proper approach, as some people would call it, the regulative principle, right, you ultimately do away with culture, right? Christendom is more or less destroyed in the name of the Lord's Day. I mean, that's just how I see it. And within America, their own flavor of Christianity, the spreading of Christendom over to the Americas, is going to have its own face. And
right.
Then what happened was some of those guys were Calvinists. Right? So they decided to adopt the Westminster standards and put a Presbyterian stamp on it. And, you know, it developed over time, of course. Like, they weren't doing the holidays and stuff like that, the holy days early on. But I mean, I forget who it was, but it was one of the Davenant guys years ago was saying that in his opinion, we need to be able to say, like, the 20th century developments of, like, the Book of Common Worship and those kind of things are legitimate expressions of Presbyterianism. I mean, they are different, but
amen to that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like, because you go back and you look at, you know, they all had manuals for worship with varying degrees of authority. They
right.
all had, you know, rules and different things that they followed in their different areas. And the American expression just developed its own, like, just like people did in all those other places. I don't see why we need to cry that they're, not that any of us are doing it, but that
right.
some people would cry that it's illegitimate because it doesn't follow the Scottish directory for public worship that only they adopted.
Yeah, do you have anything else to say?
No, my son was telling me good night.
Okay.
I was waiting.
Yeah. Right, just making sure. No, I really liked how you brought up the nature grace part of this, because I do feel like a lot of people, you know, we all, if we recite, be it the Apostles' Creed or Nicene Creed or whatever one you prefer, when we confess one holy Catholic and apostolic church, you get the Catholic and you go, okay, universal. You think of Galatians 3:28. There's neither Jew nor Greek. There's neither male nor free. There's neither bond nor free, for we are all one in Christ Jesus. Okay. So we're Catholic, neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female. Okay. You know, grace, it kind of is all encompassing, and therefore it can do away with these distinctions which divide us. You know, they're not just distinct, they divide. But the thing is, though, is that, like, yeah, like you were saying, grace doesn't destroy nature. We can affirm that there's neither male nor female, but that doesn't mean that when you and your wife walk into the church, now all of a sudden you're just sexless human beings. Like, your private parts just go away for the church service, and then they come back once you walk out or something like no, 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 that's not how it works. You retain your maleness. You do not become, like, you don't go from man to Christian. You go from man to Christian man. Grace perfects nature. And I think that, like you were saying, with you can't really divorce religious identity, like, totally from national identity. And this is where, like, some of the, you know, the people who get all, like, you know, getting a bit of like a twist about combining religion and politics. Oh no. They kind of like, oh, you're combining national identity with Jesus, and Jesus came to do away with that. And it's like, well, no, I mean, you can't totally divorce those things. Like you were saying, Trent, Christianity expresses itself in culture, and like particular cultures are, like, you know, by virtue of the very title, particular cultures aren't universal. Like, there are different peoples have different cultures, and they will do certain things in those cultures that best suit them and their character and customs and attitude and things like that. And it'd be silly to say that that's not going to show up in our Christian expressions just because Christianity is a Catholic, a universal religion. No, the universality of Christianity does not negate particular expressions of that Catholicity. And I think that's something you need to take into account when you look at Presbyterian Identity America or Scottish Presbyterianism or any other forms of Presbyterianism. I mean, even in, like, you know, third world countries that adopt, like, you know, like, there are certain African countries that are Anglican or like have Anglicans or have like Lutherans or whatever. And even there, they're not worshiping like normal European Anglicans or Lutherans would. They're doing things particular to their culture. And I think that's something that you, again, like, I'm going to repeat this, but you can't use like the Catholicity of the church to totally eliminate the particulars. I think that there are particular expressions of Catholicity that are good and healthy for both the local and the global body of Christ. And that especially applies to Presbyterian identity as well.
Right. Yeah. I think just shows the importance of having category for human law. And being able to separate, you know, divine law from human law in relation to church, worship, civil polity, these sorts of things. You know, having a very robust category for human law and its necessity to be applied to different peoples, I think saves you from a lot of this. And some of those things where I actually think one of the main differences between, like, the English and the Scottish, whether they're Presbyterian or Reformed or otherwise, is it seems like the English had a very, very robust category for valid human law and the necessity to adapt the form of religion in various countries. Like, you know, going back to, like, you know, the Elizabethan period, like, one of the main arguments for, like, the Puritans in her day and some of those early English Presbyterians, which really differ from later ones, is like, well, you know, we in England need to worship just like they worship over on the continent and, you know, these countries. We need to adopt the same thing and do it right here. And the whole argument was, well, okay, but we're not them, we're England. And so England needs to worship the way England worships and kind of has its own distinct, you know, human law built up. And kind of the same way, like, you know, Scotland kind of needs to worship the way Scotland worship, you know, worships. But now that it kind of seems like some of these purely Presbyterian projects say, well, actually, the tradition needs to freeze right here in, you know, not even in 1646, you know, later in the century when they actually get everything they want in the Church of, you know, Scotland. So, like, you know, late 17th century Church of Scotland needs to freeze right there. So we get our communion seasons and our excuses of psalmody, these sorts of things, which I'm not saying those things necessarily like bad things in and of themselves. I think those are actually, there's some healthy points and practices there. But it kind of misses that this Scottish mode of Presbyterianism isn't necessarily suited to the different peoples of the world, especially in the New World context. And I think one of the reasons that kind of maybe settle and say, you know what, I'm very English in my theology, and I'm not definitely a Scottish Presbyterian. But one of the reasons why I chose to stay in the PCA was, in many ways, like, the PCA is just the default Reformed church in the United States of America. It's the largest conservative one that's now ordaining women that actually upholds his confession. It has kind of a lineage that kind of goes back to Scottish Presbyterianism down a few hundred years down the road. But it's such its own thing now. It's its own very much American-style form of Reformed religion. It has very American ideals that, you know, I can sometimes, you know, be a little rub up against, you know, if you just read the principles, you know, the beginning of the BCO. But... And maybe the best thing for me to do is just kind of submit to the form of reformed religion that's been adopted in my country, which just kind of happens to be like the PCA. You know, of course, the PCA is a sliver compared to like just Christianity as it's adopted in America, right? But kind of does represent maybe the way the reformed religion has been accepted and kind of codified here. And the reformed religion in America, it celebrates holidays, to varying degrees. It feels free to be just as upset to draw from John Calvin even more than it may draw from Rutherford, right? If you ask your average PCA pastor, who's like a really founding theologian, like the guess I'm gonna hear is like John Calvin. But if you asked, a Presbyterian that in the Church of Scotland, they might not say John Calvin. There's been a clear shift, I think, in our identity, in American Presbyterian identity. It's kind of always emphasized the breadth of the Reformation, in kind of the healthy way. And so that's a little ramble there. One thing I thought that you brought up, Trent, that's kind of helpful was kind of like, you have the 20th century developments of like of the Book of Common Worship, the worship developments and accepting the calendar and Presbyterianism. But it's interesting to think about, kind of those developments throughout the history of the US. Like I had my buddy Jordan, who's a co-host of the podcast, is not here. He goes to Greenville, but he's went on a field trip down to Columbia to see some old Presbyterian churches. And there, you know what they had? They had the old little tiny glass communion shots that they had the wine in. And he was like, yeah, that's how they did communion then. And I was like, oh, so they did pew communion. He's like, yeah, they did pew communion. They all sat in their pews and, the communion trays were passed down in rows. Well, that's not even Scottish Presbyterianism. That's Presbyterians looking at a congregationalist practice of pew communion and saying, wow, that's a great idea. That really is pretty efficient. Let's adopt that. But in Scottish Presbyterianism, you have to have it at a table with a common cup. And so you even see like really early on in America, like they're beginning to look at their neighbors, even the congregationalists, and saying, man, that thing's pretty great. I'm going to adopt that in liturgically. That thing's pretty great. And more frequent communion becomes a thing in American Presbyterianism than it does in Scottish Presbyterianism. And you kind of always have this, not to be Hegelian, but it seems like it's always kind of going further and further to kind of a synchronistic reformed form of religion that's just very much its own thing. So I don't know if y'all have any more thoughts on that before we talk about what we're reading, but
yeah.
Good stuff, man. Good stuff.
Well, in some sense, this is just, I would say, the spirit of the first generation of reformers, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Reformation in Zurich does not look the same as in Geneva, as in Canterbury, as in Wittenberg, as in Strasbourg, and they were all okay with that. And they're all writing to one another, recognizing one another, and resourcing one another without feeling the need to universalize in such an absolute way, right? The way worshiped and those sorts of things looked.
Mm-hmm.
So if anything, it's just going further back into the tradition, right? That recovery of, your Presbyterianism is allowed to look like America. And in fact, it probably should look like mm-hmm. America in some way, shape, or form. That's really, I think, just what those first couple generations of reformers were doing. I mean, you even have letters from Calvin, right? The reformer of reformers to Cranmer. He doesn't agree with every single call that Cranmer's going to make, but he recognizes that Cranmer's reform is going to look different
mm-hmm.
and makes suggestions that I don't think he would suggest for his context to Cranmer based on Cranmer's different context.
Right.
Right. This should just be kind of like normal reformation.
Mm-hmm.
This non-universalizing.
Right.
Yeah. And in some ways, the faith, I'm trying to say this without sounding heretical, but your faith is only as useful or beneficial as you can make it, palatable to the people that you're ministering to. Right. So like, let's just say I did hold to the original directory for worship, exclusive psalmody and all that stuff and communion seasons and do all those things. How wise would it be to implement that in, my context? Like, 'cause it's very not un-American in like this, hold America high status, but just as far as the people go, it would be so foreign. And I mean, that's one of even within American Presbyterianism, like you had the Northern and the Southern Presbyterian Church, and they both had their own flavors, right? So you have to have this understanding that you're taking the faith once for all delivered to the saints and making it palatable, right, in a non-heretical sense, to the people that you're ministering to. Because, you know, and this is one of the reasons that it's so weird to me that like Scottish people come over here or Indian people come over here and become pastors and stay over here. And that these churches, you know, it's just, it seems, especially in the ARP, that big church in Colombia, they love foreign preachers. Like, I just don't get it. Right. It's just like, what gives? Right. What, how? Anyway, I don't want to get off on a tangent, but you see what I'm saying with the whole nature grace relationship. Like, you know, if I was planning a church where I grew up, which I'm not far from, and you know, we didn't do Christmas, didn't have a Christmas service, didn't celebrate Easter in the name of the regular principle, people would look at me like I had three heads. And I think they should. But, you know, for some people, that's just a, you know, a notch in your belt of martyrdom. You know, and I think it lacks common sense and it lacks an understanding of human nature.
That's really helpful. It's really helpful. Yeah. Go ahead.
I'm not going to let human nature get in the way of me being TR, Trent. I've got to have that notch in my belt. I have to take zero exceptions because it sounds cool when I say it.
Yeah, I like to, I've been involved in a couple of different chats throughout the years, and we would, one of the more common names we would use was more reformed than Jesus. And, yes. You know, like the people that have to insert the word elect in verses where it's not there. and you know, where they just have this particular identity where they're always virtue signaling or whatever.
For God so loved the elect.
For God so loved the world, the elect, he gave his only begotten son. Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. I think, Trent, I think that's a good note to end this conversation on. I think really, that's really helpful for me as like a young guy that's kind of, you know, in the PCA and hearing from a, you know, a seasoned new, you know, seasoned minister about how you're applying this in the PCA. It's actually really encouraging to me and makes me feel like there's hope, you know, for a more English-minded guy like me in the PCA. So thank you for your comments.
Yeah, no problem.
So now we're going to transition into what we're reading, which I forgot to warn both Addison and Trent on. So Matthew and I will go first. Just a little conversation about what we're reading right now. And I'll let Matthew go first.
All right, yeah, I'll go first. You mentioned that we were going to transition to that, and I briefly wrote down some notes because I'm actually reading a lot of books right now. I mean, what am I not, though? Jeez. Anyways, though, I'll just start off with the first book that I'm reading that I know that Jonathan is also reading, and that's John Davenant's On the Death of Christ, which, you know, you know, this is a Davenant-sponsored podcast. I'll shill Davenant here. They just published a new translation done by the one and only Michael Lynch. So if you haven't bought it, you're literally insane and should get a mental assessment. So buy that because I'm reading through it right now. And yeah, I'm reading through it. I haven't read through a lot, admittedly, because I've been busy with other readings, but I will finish it at some point. I started reading it after I finished John Owen's work on the atonement, on the death of death. So yeah. Another book I'm reading is a biography of John Paul Jones by Samuel Eliot Morison. If you guys have ever heard the famous Johnny Horton song on John Paul Jones, please give that a listen. It'll give you a good purview into this wonderful American hero who fought for the British, the Americans, the French, and the Russians. So he was a pirate. He was a fun guy. So I'm reading about him. Another book I'm reading, I got three more to give you guys before I transition. I'm reading Pastor Sean Mathis, who's an OPC pastor, his book called Is the Church Pro-Gay? So that should be interesting. It's a kind of a depressing read, but I'm getting through it. So yeah, I'm reading that on the issue of homosexuality in the church. Second book I'm reading, or not second, we've gone through so many already. Reading Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy, which is very interesting. Very depressing as well. I'm just in a depressing mood right now reading all these books. And then the last book that I'm reading, I caved in. I got it after I saw the movie. I'm reading Dune. So yeah, those are the books I'm reading through as of right now.
That's great. And hey, you also, didn't you just read the Bible in 3 months?
I did. Yeah, that was intense, dude.
Thank you for not bragging about it, you know, but I wanted to ask you about
it.
Yeah,
no, that was intense. But I will admit, I will, I'm not going to lie and seem like I was pious and sitting down reading for an hour and a half to 2 hours. I listened to a lot of it. Okay. Like it was very hard to keep up with, but I did it. I got through the whole thing in 3 months.
Wow. Wow. I hope to absorb some of your grace next time I see you, you know. So that's great, brother.
Yeah.
Speaking of English Presbyterianism, not that John Davenant was an English Presbyterian, but you know, a third of the assembly was probably a hypothetical universalist on the issue of the atonement. At least that's what Dr. Lynch says. So I'll parrot that. If that's wrong, you can attack him. But that's why I'm also reading On the Death of Christ by John Davenant in this new beautiful volume that Davenant has put out. I'm excited that Davenant has finally published a book by John Davenant after 10 years of existence. And we all know, you know, they chose the name John Davenant because Bradwell John couldn't choose the name the Hooker Institute after Richard Hooker. And so they went with Davenant. You know, that was the backup name, you know.
Sorry, I forgot I didn't mute my mic.
So I'm reading that. We're actually doing a book club on it. In the Davenant Discord server, Common Room, we'll be working through it starting next week, actually, over 6 weeks, working through the content of Davenant's argument. If you want to join in on that, you should become a donor to Davenant, and you can hop in the Discord. I don't know what the exact threshold of money you have to give to hop into that, but I don't imagine it's all that much, so you should definitely come join us in the Discord in those conversations. On top of that, I've been listening through The Fellowship of the Ring on the Spotify, and it's been great. I've never actually read The Lord of the Rings, and I've only watched the first movie like three times. So it's been great to kind of slowly listen through the trilogy. I took a Tolkien class this last semester with Anthony Cirilla on the Silmarillion. And so I decided it's time to start listening to Lord of the Rings.
Jonathan,
yes.
I'm going to have to cut you off really quick to let you know that I also just finished Fellowship of the Rings.
Okay, well.
3 days ago. So
I don't know how you read that much. You must be like, I don't know. You must have a better life than me. And if I'm allowed, I'll do what I'm about to read. Dr. Lynch recommended this book. So I'm about to read The Crisis of British Protestantism by Hunter Powell. It's all about the differences in church polity between English Presbyterians and Independents and Scottish Presbyterians and Episcopalians. So I'm hoping to kind of hop into that world. And yeah, that's it for me. Addison, what are you reading, brother?
I was actually prepared for this question because I was one of the OG listeners to Irenic Protestants. So I knew this question was coming. I'm in between terms with Davenant and I'm on spring break. So I'm just reading stuff for fun. So rereading Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, because that's one of the ones I teach at work. Great book. Reading, I can't remember who the author is. It's like everyday life in early colonial America. And so it's just kind of the basics of what life looked like in the 17th century American colonies. And it's fascinating. It is amazing how weak we all are compared to them when they came over here and carved civilization out of a wilderness. I'm also receiving the admonishment of Timon Klein and Michael Lynch, and I'm doing the reading. So I'm finally reading Stephen Wolfe's Case for Christian Nationalism. I've had it for forever. I bought it a couple years ago when it came out, I think, but never had the time to get through it. So I'm making my way through that now. And then have been ever since Lynch's Westminster Confession class spending way too much time on the Westminster Assembly Project's website, just reading all sorts of sermons and treatises from different divines, trying to get a flavor for what exactly they were doing and what they were about. So that's what I'm up to now. And then as soon as the new term starts, I'll be doing a lot of Aristotle. So
you're in the Aristotle seminar. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's Hey,
great.
Addison, what's a site called where you can access like all those sermons from the Westminster Divines and all that?
Yeah, Westminster Assembly Project. So it's a westminsterassembly.org is the website. But yeah, you can search it like under their names by
Oh,
topics.
very epic.
Yeah,
Nice.
the topic search isn't great, so I would just go by their names and then look at the titles of
Okay.
everything to kind of find what you want. So you kind of it takes some time to find what you're looking for, but it is
No,
great.
this is great. I'm gonna use the heck out of this thing. Thank you.
I found an awesome sermon from Stephen Marshall about the civil magistrate that I sent to Trent a while back, and it's like the most concise defense I think you can find of Christian civil magistracy. It's pretty good.
You should send that to me. Yeah, definitely.
Will do.
Yeah. Well, Trent, we saved the best for last. What's been up with you? What have you been reading?
Yeah, so a lot of my reading is devoted particularly to church stuff. Two books I'm reading for that are The Israel of God by O. Palmer Robertson. I love O. Palmer Robertson, but I hate this book. We're reading it with our men's group, and I have as many critiques of it as I have praises. It's a very frustrating book. But reading that, The Deacon by some Dutch guy, Van, whoever, it's pretty good. He gives like a historical presentation of what the deacon was like and his understanding of it, the scriptures, the early church, and the Reformation, and then modern application. He deals with women in the diaconate and all that stuff. So, been reading that with my session. And then I've been listening to Defenders of the West by Ibrahim. Really enjoying that.
Base.
Very, it's a startling listen, I guess you'll say, just because of all the things that you learn that Christians of the past would do for the faith. You know, whether they were right or wrong is another discussion, but just seeing the courage that they had for the
They were
sake of
right.
Christ. Oh, I just, yeah, for sure. I believe they're right. And then I was writing these down while y'all were talking. I got in the mail today, and I'm going to be looking at it. I'm excited to receive it. You might have heard of this, Jonathan. The Sydney Psalter. You
From
ever heard
the
of that?
Diocese of Sydney in the
No.
no.
So a brother and sister did a poetic rendering of the
Yes.
Psalms.
Yes.
John Donne loved it.
Yes.
You know, it's kind of like a very English thing, but it's
Right.
beautiful. Like it makes me think of Anthony Esalen when I read it, because I always think about him when I read poetry. And then Southern Presbyterian Leaders is another book that I just got. I think the author's last name is White, of course. Yeah, it's good. I really appreciate reading about Southern Presbyterianism in general. I mean, I have my disagreements with them on some things, but I'm a very Southern guy. Very proud to be from Dixie, and reading pastors who also were as well is quite encouraging to me. So, and I named my son after James Henley Thornwell. So,
Oh, there you go. That's a
yeah.
true Southern Presbyterian. And I'm guessing you might have Dabney on your bookshelf.
Oh, plenty of Dabney.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
Yep.
The St. Thomas of the South, I hear,
Yeah. Yeah.
has been thrown out there.
No, I mean you hear all the praise that he got. I mean, he was called the best theologian in America by the Hodges and those guys. They tried to get him to come to Princeton, but he wouldn't leave the South.
One of the things I liked this semester was Lynch put me on Dabney for the first time, and I've always been a little, Dabney, scared, and of course, there's the things, we all know.
The
Jonathan
things.
Edwards said the same things, but he gets a pass, I guess. So that's great. Awesome. Well, thank you all for joining us today on the Irenic Protestant podcast. If you liked our show, please, share it with a friend, like, comment, do all the things that are nice to do, for these sorts of things. And we'll see you next time on the Irenic Protestant podcast.